This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The U.S. Justice Department announced charges against an Air Force officer said to have aligned herself with Iran. Reuters' Jillian Kitchener explains.
Former U.S. Air Force intelligence officer Monica Witt charged Wednesday with spying for Iran and allegedly helping Iran in a cyber operation that targeted her former colleagues. Officials say 39-year-old Witt, after defecting to Iran in 2013, supplied classified information about U.S. intelligence officers she had worked with during her military career. Four Iranian nationals were also charged in connection to the cyber attacks, and Washington sanctioned two Iran-based firms. Witt, who was once granted high-level security clearances, was allegedly recruited for the cyber spying operation after attending conferences in Iran organized by one of the newly sanctioned firms.
Reuters' Jillian Kitchener reporting. U.S. President Trump was noncommittal when asked about whether he's going to sign bipartisan legislation to prevent another government shutdown over border wall funding. Instead, the president said he was looking for landmines in the bill. VOA Steve Herman.
He indicated, however, he is pleased with preliminary figures in the border security deal worked out by a committee of Republicans and Democrats, but says the opposition party is being stingy when it comes to funding for the wall.
We're building a lot of wall right now with money that we already have.
Trump also tells reporters he does not want to see another partial shutdown of the U.S. government, saying that would be a terrible thing. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
American and Taliban officials are set to meet Monday in Pakistan for a new round of direct peace negotiations aimed at paving the way for a political settlement to the 17-year-old war in Afghanistan. Until now, the Gulf states of Qatar and the United Arab Emirates have played host to the meetings, where U.S. Special Representative for Afghan Reconciliation Zalmay Khalilzad and a senior insurgent have had their respective delegations. This is VOA News. On a 248-177 vote, the Democrat-controlled U.S. House voted to cut off U.S. military assistance to the Saudi coalition fighting in Yemen. The measure must now be voted on by the U.S. Senate, which passed a similar measure before the 2018 midterm election, setting up a possible shutdown, I should say showdown, with the White House. U.S. lawmakers from both parties have not only displayed disgust by the carnage in Yemen, but many are so angry over President Trump's tepid reaction to the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The White House has threatened a veto if the measure does pass the Senate. A federal judge ruled that ex-Trump campaign chief Paul Manafort lied to prosecutors. That means he broke his plea deal with special counsel Robert Mueller's team. And that agreement breached, Manafort may now face a long prison term. We get more from Reuters' Ryan Brooks.
The judge also said the lies were about topics critical to the Russia investigation. The special counsel's team and Manafort's lawyers have wrangled for weeks over whether he delayed the Russia probe by lying. Robert Mueller and his team are looking into whether Moscow interfered in the 2016 election and into possible collusion between Russia and U.S. President Donald Trump's campaign. The judge on Wednesday found there was evidence to show Manafort lied about three topics, including communication with his former business partner, Konstantin Kilimnik.
That's Reuters' Ryan Brooks reporting. Hundreds of protesters marched to the National Palace in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, Wednesday, to send a message to President Jovenel Moïse it's time to leave. But so far, the president has remained silent. One protester leader called on residents of all neighborhoods in the capital to march in the National Palace to show the president that they mean business. VOA Creole reporters saw SEMA security officers in position around the palace to maintain order there. The Associate Administrator for Science at NASA has now declared that the Opportunity mission is now complete. Speaking of the U.S. Mars rover mission that outlasted its projected lifespan by more than 14 years, known as Opportunity, the rover succumbed to a Martian dust storm and lost contact with Earth nearly 8 months ago. NASA gave up on it after more than 800 attempts to reestablish contact. Opportunity was launched in 2003 and reached Mars a year later, and close on the heels of its twin, a rover named Spirit. Both rovers, roughly the size of golf carts, were tasked with activities that would last about 90 days. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan President Kenyatta has given striking nurses until this Friday to return to work or be fired.
Any nurse who fails to report to work as directed above will be dismissed by the county governments and the Ministry of Health.
Nigerian youth are urged to show their numbers in Saturday's presidential election. There's a debate in Malawi about the English proficiency of one of the ruling party's vice presidential candidates. A captain is the first to confess before Gambia's ongoing Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings. And this week, Cameroon charged Maurice Kamto, the man who claimed he won last year's election.
The government is charging him with a couple of ridiculous charges, I will say. The first is rebellion. The second is hostility à la patrie, or hostility to the fatherland.
That's Professor Patrice Ngana, head of the campaign to free Maurice Kamto. And global unemployment reaches its lowest level in a decade. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has ordered striking nurses at public hospitals to end their ongoing strike and resume work by tomorrow Friday, or risk being fired. The president's ultimatum comes as clinical and laboratory officers have also threatened to join striking nurses over the government's failure to honor a collective bargaining agreement by county governments. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
Speaking after meeting with the Council of Governors representatives in State House Nairobi, President Uhuru Kenyatta said that the striking nurses are interfering with his agenda to Kenyans of ensuring universal health care for all. Kenyatta has given the governors the mandate to fire the striking nurses for having paralyzed the health services.
Any nurse who fails to report to work as directed above will be dismissed by the county governments and the Ministry of Health. The respective county governments will therefore be at liberty to undertake any action as they deem appropriate against personnel who fail to resume duty as directed by the Employment and Labor Relations Court. We cannot allow unlawful industrial action to derail us from our focus of taking Kenya forward.
Last week, the court ordered nurses to suspend the strike for at least 60 days and give room for negotiations, an order that the nurses ignored, prompting action from the head of state. President Kenyatta says he has ordered the police to take action on the nurses who might harass their colleagues who are on duty.
All nurses should resume duty with effect, and in any case, not later than Friday, the 15th of February, 2019, at 8 a.m. Number two, as the Commander-in-Chief of the Kenya Defense Forces, I have instructed the National Police Service to take stern action against those picketeers who may intimidate or otherwise harass public servants who intend to go to work.
Nurses have paralyzed health services in public hospitals for the second week now, as efforts to have them avert the strike hit rocks. However, the Kenya Union of Nurses Secretary General Seth Panyako maintains that the strike is legal and that the notices were issued.
The strike is ongoing. I have read 13 employers. Strike is on. Nothing has changed. There are others who are beginning on Monday. I said that. There are others beginning on Tuesday next week. I said that. And as a union, if I start to be challenged and to go into starting to make political statements in matters of workers, then I'll be deviating from my core mandate. I'll also be engaging in political gimmicks, because the Council of Governors is not an association mandated by law to act on behalf of any employee in Kenya.
President Kenyatta's threats comes at a time when the clinical officers have threatened to go on strike from 6th of
May. The Cameroon rebellion is against the of results again against the BIA. Two members of Kamto's Cameroon Government Party are also on trial for the same charges. Patrice Nanga of New York University has declined to free Maurice Kamto. He says the charges against Mr. Kamto are politically motivated.
The government is charging him with a couple of charges. I will say, at first, is rebellion. The second is hostility to the fatherland. But the most important charges are on him. But they haven't been brought yet to the truth. He will not be
able to.
You have to vote for the government.
Come to. You are speaking with me from New York's Stony Brook University. There is tension in the air as Nigeria prepares to vote in Saturday's presidential election. Incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari, who is 76 years old, of the ruling All Progressive Congress Party, and former Vice President Atiku Abubakar of the opposition People's Democratic Party, are the leading candidates. But young people could decide the results of the election. Over 60% of Nigeria's 84 million registered voters are 18 to 35 years old, and some analysts say the youth vote could be decisive. VOA's Peter Clotte, who is covering the Nigerian elections, sat down with Ezekiel Kuni, the spokesman of the Northern Nigeria Youth Organization.
The organization is sensitizing with youths, as you can go by the name NNYO. It's sensitizing with the youths. Let the youth shun violence. Let the youth see election. Let it not be a do-or-die affair. We are looking at a position where the youth should fully participate and elect a credible person, a credible leader to lead them, not to be used as thugs. We also feel that we should participate fully, as in the Northern Nigerian youth, we are particular on the northern part of the nation. It is non-political, it is non-partisan, it is non-religious organization.
So far, ahead of this election, what has your organization been doing in the way of sensitization? Give me specific things that you have done to encourage the youth to participate in this election, because some of them are saying they are not reaping any benefit from the system, so why should they go and vote at all?
In reality, every program that comes is not everybody that participates and gets a share of it. But we, from our organization, we feel that the youth should take part. The youth should be active in election that is coming. We have taken a campaign to several states. We have organized seminars to where we will see that the youths go out in mass and collect their PVC, which is the permanent voter's card. And now if they collect it, that is the power of voting. That is the power of their leadership that you decide at this point in time. We have done such sensitizations in so many communities, mention Kano State, mention Jigawa State, mention Taraba State. Here in Lagos, we have done that with our small communities like visiting Agege, Alimosho, and some other communities to sensitize with the youths. And they came out in a well-recognized mass.
Let me ask you this, because people have expressed concern that the youth are sometimes used by some of these political leaders to intimidate and harass opponents so they prevent their supporters from going to the polls to vote.
This is not new, because over some time this has been happening, and it is the reason why we came on board, to make sure that the youths are not used as thugs, to make sure that the youths are not there just to vote for the money's sake. They are not there for any other purpose but to elect a credible leader. And the youth should shun violence. That's our gospel. We are preaching it, that every youth should see it that is his or her own civil right to vote and to do the proper thing, not to be used by any political leader as a thug or for any reason.
That was Ezekiel Kuni, the spokesman of the Northern Nigerian Youth Organization. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty, who is covering the Nigerian election. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 14th. In the Gambia, a senior army captain has emerged as the first witness to confess before the country's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC, about his role in torturing a former agriculture minister under former President Saldauda Jawara's rule. Captain Boubacar Barr, an active serving member of Gambia's military, confessed that he was the soldier who broke Omar Amadou Diallo's eye back in October of 1995. Pandere Umbai reports.
Captain Boubacar Barr says he was in his 20s when the incident happened. He says he tortured Omar Amadou Diallo, a former agriculture minister under Jawara's rule, based on what he called misleading information he received from one of his colleagues the late Almar Momane, about Jallow's alleged plans to overthrow the former military junta.
He started to explain to me that Oje is conniving with the Europeans. You know, that time there was sanction embargo against the Gambia. And then, you know, he's working on modalities to bring mercenaries into the Gambia. And then they will overthrow the new government, and then they will spoil the revolution. And in the process, the mercenaries who are merciless, they will end up also killing all of us.
Captain Bass says he was young and gullible at the time. He then descended on the former minister and started torturing him. Jallow lost one of his eyes during the process.
As I came close to him, I punched him on the stomach. You know, I hit him on the stomach, then he bent down, and then I started beating him with my hands. So suddenly, you know, because Fajara Barracks was the headquarters of the gendarmerie, then when I look around, I was not satisfied with hitting and kicking him with my hands and my feet. I saw that, you know, these truncheons that were being used by the gendarmes, for some reason, I don't know, they were littered around.
Captain Bass says he had regretted his past actions. He has apologized to Omar Ahmed Jallow, his family, and the Gambian nation for his callous actions against the former minister. He says the torture he inflicted on Jallow had tormented him over the years.
The reasons why I couldn't face him to apologize him that time were two reasons. One is that person under whose rule these things happened was still the president of the Republic of the country that time. And when you go to apologize, one, you don't know how he is, one, you don't know how the person you are apologizing is going to react. One. Number two, also, you don't know how also, under whose watch you did this thing also is going to react.
Ba was arrested during Gambia's month-long political impasse back in December of 2016. He says his arrest had to do with his refusal to fire bomb petrol stations located in the Greater Banjul area. He says he was given orders by General Saul Badji, a close confidant of dictator Jammeh, to engage in such sabotage activities, but he refused. The goal for the sabotage, he says, was to attribute it to the opposition, so that Jammeh can arrest them. Bass torture victim Omar Ahmed Jallow says he had forgiven all those who had tortured him during Jammeh's rule.
And I want people to know that we are all believers. For me, I have said, all those who tortured me, all those who did these bad things to me, I've forgiven them. What they have done to my prophet is worse than what they did to me. What they did to Prophet Isa is worse than what they did to me. What they did to Prophet Abraham is worse than what they did for me.
Meanwhile, Laminwa Juara, a former staunch opponent of dictator Jammeh's rule, also appeared before the commission on Wednesday. Juara testified that he had been arrested and tortured on numerous occasions during Jammeh's rule. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
In Malawi, where candidates are campaigning for the country's May 21st presidential election, the English proficiency of one of incumbent President Peter Mutharika's vice presidential candidate is the topic of discussion among political commentators. English is the official language of Malawi, but some say Everton Chimulirenji, one of the four vice presidential candidates of President Mutharika, can barely read or speak English fluently. But some say being unable to speak English fluently should never be a yardstick for leadership. Rafik Hajat is the executive director of the Institute for Policy Interaction in Malawi.
The fluency in English is vital. It's actually a legal requirement for a person in holding office of that high rank to be conversant and fluent in English, because after all, you have to have a minimum of a secondary school certificate in order to qualify for nomination as a vice president or president, or for that matter, for a member of parliament.
So why do you suppose that he was chosen if he's not that fluent? Let's remember now that English is the official language of Malawi.
I do believe that there is a strategy here that is not obvious at the moment. Indeed, it has led to much puzzlement and scratching of heads.
What do you mean? The comment I'm hearing also is that his appointment or his selection to be the vice presidential candidate for President Mutharika has caused somewhat of a split within the ruling party?
Yes, I wouldn't call it a split. I think it has heightened tensions and divisions and factions within the party. The reason for that is that there are actually four vice presidents in the party, one for each region, the north, the center, the south, and the east. All of them had an eye on that post, but the vice president from the southern region, who comes from the same ethnic tribe as the incumbent president, was pretty confident of getting that position, and indeed, to all the extents and purposes, was gearing himself for that role.
What are people saying in terms of why President Mutharika picked Mr. Chimulerenji? What is the discussion there?
What I'm saying that there is much puzzlement regarding that decision because the nominee is deemed to be a political lightweight. He was the governor of a district called Ncheu in the central region 3 years ago. He was appointed to cabinet 3 months ago. He is not reckoned as a political heavyweight. And within the DPP, you have got some very powerful people who actually feel let down or betrayed at having been passed over.
To Mr. Chimulerenji's defense, there are those who say even the former president, Bakali Muluzi, he spoke broken English.
Well, I beg to differ. In fact, the previous president, Dr. Bakili Muluzi, was a people's person. He had the charisma which used to extend to all and sundry rank and file. And when he held a meeting, he could sway that crowd like very few others. And his fluency certainly was not lacking.
That was Rafik Ajad, Executive Director of the Institute for Policy Interaction in Malawi. You are speaking with me from Malawi's capital, Lilongwe. A new report finds the world's unemployment rate has dropped to 5%, the lowest level since the global economic crisis in 2008. The International Labour Organization reports the jobs being created, however, are poor quality jobs that keep most of the world's workers mired in poverty. Lisa Schneier reports.
Slightly more than 172 million people globally were unemployed in 2018. That is about 2 million less than the previous year. The International Labour Organization expects the global unemployment rate of 5% to remain essentially unchanged over the next few years. The ILO report finds a majority of the 3.3 billion people employed throughout the world, though, are working under poor conditions that do not guarantee them a decent living. ILO Deputy Director General for Policy, Deborah Greenfield, says many people have jobs that do not offer them economic security, lack material well-being, and decent work opportunities.
These jobs tend to be informal and characterized by low pay, insecurity, and little or no access to social protection and rights at work. Worldwide, 2 billion workers, or 61%, were in informal employment.
Over the past 30 years, the report finds a great decline in working poverty in middle-income countries, but the situation remains serious in low- and middle-income countries. The report says one quarter of those employed there do not earn enough to escape extreme or moderate poverty. Regionally, the ILO reports only 4.5% of sub-Saharan Africa's working-age population is unemployed, with 60% employed. ILO Director of Research Damien Grimshaw says these good statistics are deceptive.
In sub-Saharan Africa, we find 18 of the top 20 countries with the highest rates of poverty, and they're also the countries with very, very high informal employment, so higher than 80% in most countries in sub-Saharan Africa, despite having some of the lowest unemployment rates in the world.
Grimshaw says the unemployment rate is not a good measure of labor market performance or economic performance in countries with high rates of informality. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That is it for this Thursday, February 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Butte in Washington wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello. Hello, peepstas. Welcome to the weekend. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Boy, do I have a show for you. 55 minutes of cool, commercial-free Pan-African music. Hear your favorite current Afro beats. Discover new music from Ghana and meet Blinky Bill from Nairobi. He's just released a new album.
Even if you know a lot of things, there's no guarantee that you're gonna see it tomorrow.
Revel in earthy African classics from Mali, Cape Verde, DRC, and South Africa. All this and more this Sunday at 15:05 and 20:05 UTC. Just tune in to your local FM station and meet me there. Music Time in Africa.